Welcome back to the Jewish Futurism Lab, where we unpack Torah, tech, and tomorrow. I'm your host, Mike Wirth, Jewish futurist, community artist, and design educator, coming to you from Crowntown, Charlotte, North Carolina. Today, I'm sitting down with April Powers, Vice President of Engagement at Project Shema and co-founder of Jubian Princess. April is a Black Jewish inclusion strategist, facilitator, and bridge builder whose work asks what it really takes to make belonging possible in Jewish life and beyond. We go through her journey in corporate DEI and children's publishing to the amazing place she is now. Let's get into it, y'all. All right, friends, welcome back to the lab. So today's conversation is a special one for me. Some of you may know that I was adopted at birth and raised by a Jewish family. And as an adult, I got to meet both of my biological parents. I found brand new family, and I took a DNA test to understand my whole heritage. My biological mother, Stacy, may she rest in peace, was biracial. And her father, my grandfather, Ed Jackson, may he rest in peace, is Black. And her mother, my grandmother, may she also rest in peace, Liz, was Irish. So that's a much larger story, but learning that has been joyful and deeply fulfilling. I just have so much family now, all these places everywhere. But when I took the DNA test, it also brought a little bit of a mystery. Alongside my European and African ancestry, it showed that I had 12% Ashkenazi Jewish through my mother's side. So my cousins share it. My aunts also appear to have even more of it, but no one knows who this Jewish ancestor was. So my Black family, the Jacksons and the Scotts, the matriarch, Edith Scott Jackson, my great-grandmother, who lived to 101, may she also rest in peace, who I got to meet. She grew up in Harlem in the turn of the 20th century and really had a heyday in the 20s and 30s. And somewhere in that family history, there is a Jewish story still waiting to be uncovered. So today, friends, I'm joined by April Powers, who is a Black Jewish inclusion strategist and a vice president at an incredible place, Project Shema. She's vice president of engagement. I've taken multiple trainings with April, and we've been able to kind of a little bit talk about this situation. You know, my family has a lot of light-skinned people, and we mix with European ancestry, so I do not appear to have any African ancestry, right, despite my mother being biracial. So we talk about April's upbringing, being Black and Jewish, understanding those worlds, and having them just like marry together in this profoundly joyous upbringing and then adult experience. April is a pioneer in DEI, working for major corporations, and then for the Children's Book Illustration Society, and then ultimately bringing her skills to Project Shema, where she is now. We talk about so many fun things, our favorite Black Jews. We talk about the Different World reboot. If you're a Gen Xer or even millennial, you might remember A Different World, which was such a cool show to watch, right? Dwayne Wayne, Whitley, right? Ron. I mean, just all these favorite characters, including Lisa Bonet, right? Who was on The Cosby Show. And while that wasn't a part of her character, the real life fact that she is Black and Jewish, it's something that if you grew up and understood that that was a part of your culture and your heritage, that that's an amazing thing to see represented, right? So we talk about that The Different World, the new show, they have an amazing opportunity to take advantage and show Black and Jewish identities. That would be amazing, right? As a really wonderful thing. So friends, we got into some great conversation. We talked Jewish futurism, the future of our people, colorism in the Jewish community, and Afrofuturism, all in one. Super, super amazing. And oh my gosh, just like this person has so much joy and has so much great work to still do and spread around the world. So friends, without further ado, here's my interview with April Powers. April, welcome to the show today. So excited to have you.
Mike, thank you so much. I love everything you're putting out there. And so I am delighted beyond just, you know, knowing you and all of your work that we get to do this podcast together.
It's a thank you so much, and it's a long time coming. I've done I think three trainings with April at the helm for Project Shema through my university, the Holocaust Center, Stan Greenspan, and our Jewish Federation in Charlotte. And each time I've learned new things. So it's the amazing perspective and understanding of cultural scaffolding and things like that, and the dynamics. I think really cuts the mustard, right? Allows us to get into things. But April, folks want to know, you didn't just show up from space, right? As a superhero, you have probably one of the most amazing origin stories we're excited to hear. You grew up in LA, right? You went to Berkeley. We're excited to hear about like the thread and the genesis of how April became April and does the things now. Where did those things show up in your life?
Well, I think growing up in a multicultural family, a multi-religious family, a family that, you know, like any American family, right? We had different religions, we had different ethnicities, we had different socioeconomic status, disability, neuroatypicality. We've had poverty, drug abuse, substance abuse, people who were unhoused for periods of time, just the typical American story that for, you know, when you're growing up, you don't realize that it's different until you're actually put into a school environment where you stand out a little bit. So for me, my cousins were Black and Jewish. They grew up in South Central. My Jewish grandparents wouldn't have a single white identified great grandchild. They are either Jutinos or Bluish or Hebrews or Jubian princes and princesses, right? So my lived experience is one of multi-ethnic Jewish life. And that to me was normal. I lived and grew up in Los Angeles and in San Diego for a time, but really the way that I look, if people can see a photo of me, I'm sort of invisibly Black, invisibly Jewish, unless you know, you know. And I've lived all over the world. I speak a few languages. So I've heard all the things about all my people, even from all my people on multiple in multiple languages and continents. And that led me to do DEI work. So I've led DEI for some of the world's largest companies. Inclusion is a core value, not only for me personally, but just in my family and the way that we grew up. And so that has been a really interesting life journey. I would say this is not a strategy, but I have not asked for most of the jobs that I have had. There has been somebody who said, you, get over here. We want you to do this. We see this in you and we want you here. So I met my first boss at a car wash and he, you know, said, if I can ever help, let me know. So I had a summer internship with him and ended up in recruiting, saw an opportunity to work at Nestle. And then, and I also had started my own search firm, but I rebuilt their finance recruiting department and diversified their finance team. And then they asked me to do DEI. And I said, I don't know what this thing is. And they said, we'll get you the best training. And they really did. Then somebody from Nestle invited me to Amgen, the world's largest biotech. And then I ended up, I was recruited to be the global head of diversity, equity, and inclusion for the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, which was like a dream job. I had written a children's book with a multi-ethnic Black Jewish girl that could be a Jutina or Black and Jewish, and you know, with food issues, just like me, because we have tummy issues in our community. And so I was so excited. I was thinking, wow, Hashem really has this figured out. Little did I know what Hashem's plans were for me. It wasn't to necessarily publish a children's book at that time. It was me being front and center in some anti-Semitism controversy that led me to the work that I'm doing now. And so I don't know how much you want me to get into that cancellation or go back into growing up or where you would like me to go with
I think you've unpacked a lot of great things. I would love to let's stay in the DEI, like the origins of that, right? Because I love what you said before, and it made me go, "Whoa, okay, that must have been incredible." So, what was it like, kind of being in that position, right? Being anointed, right? Really, in this the way you described it, that's amazing, right? Mazel tov. To now feel the wave of DEI, because it came fast, right? To corporate America, to the classroom, right? To universities and colleges everywhere, school system. What was that like? How did you kind of see, did it challenge anything about your identity or like things you were like, whoa, we might have to address some new things here?
So I was very sensitive to, probably overly sensitive to not overly represent my identities, whether that was woman, Black, or Jewish, although I've fought for everybody, including Black folks and women. I tried to explain Jewish identity. I think, like many DEI professionals, I did not combat anti-Semitism in the way that I would prescribe today. Mm-hmm. I would say DEI at that time was in some ways a check the box for many corporations. It was really challenging to get the funding that you might have seen in a post George Floyd moment. Like that, you saw a rush of funding and a flooding of ideas and people. I'd like to talk about that too, because that was a really important moment where I think we ended up, like they say, flooding the zone with people who were not trained. When I was asked to do DEI, I said, I can't do this thing. This is not my background, and I don't feel comfortable pretending that it is. And so they did put me in a lot of, you know, an immersive training and made sure that I was, you know, able to talk about this thing that we were taking on as a national, you know, one of the largest food companies in the world, right? Okay. But strategy is always, you know, an interesting thing to try to figure out. You know, what is the focus? What is the priority? How much money do we have to do this thing? And then how do you affect a culture change inside of an organization? And for me, part of that was just recruiting. Like my vibe on recruiting was I didn't look at names, I didn't look at clubs, I just looked at the actual skill set. And because of that, I would say I'm name blind. I really didn't care about names. And so I would just bring in the person that I thought was best and ended up diversifying, you know, different teams on the fact that I didn't care about names or what they look like. I just really cared about the resume. And I think that was one of the skills that I brought to the inclusion space through the recruiter lens. And then DEI had come out of, you know, diversity at that time, which was a little bit more name, blame, and shame, kind of what we've circled back to now. And we learned that that is not going to win hearts and minds. Like we've already gone through this cycle. When you talk about futurism is sometimes repeating the past yeah. the past and making the same mistakes, and you're watching this thing whiz past you and saying, wait, why are we still doing this? So I was not in DEI while that was happening. That had, you know, I'd heard the rumors of that not quite working, and thank goodness I wasn't a part of that. And then you get to, well, I'll slow down and see if you have questions about anything I said, but, I definitely still want to talk about the name, blame, and shame DEI that has resurfaced.
Oh, for sure. I'm curious, just as we're kind of threading, was there any, specific voices or, anybody that you really learned from that was a great mentor to you?
You know, I took my course from Garden Schwartz and Rowe. They're like the godmothers of of inclusion. One of them is Jewish. Both are self-identified as white women. And I love their inclusion model. I think it's been expanded, which I also appreciate, but just knowing where the core model has come from and things to think about has really helped me. I think there have been a lot of personal mentors that people might not know their names, but who have guided me along the way. I would say Ken Bentley, who was the vice president at Nestle, who tapped me on the shoulder, was an incredible mentor to me. And I still feel that he is. Like, I could reach out to him anytime. And he's doing incredible work with the golf world now in his retirement, making sure that Black children are playing golf and getting involved in the game. And so knowing that that's just been a core value for him, and knowing that I could reach out to him at any time was a huge blessing for me, and that he believed in me at the time, because having champions in a room when you're not there is, as a Black woman, as a Black Jewish woman, is a big deal.
That's huge. Why don't we talk about, it seems like corporate DEI had its own culture. And then there was, like I was mentioning, there's DEI initiatives happening in other places. You know, what could other places learn from the successes and lessons, you know, and failures, right, of corporate DEI that you've seen?
I think corporate DEI, the one cool part about corporate DEI is you spend so much of your day at work that it's almost a captive audience in which to have these conversations, much like a university or a campus, right? You have young people and they're my hearts and minds for, you know, a good 4 years or more, depending on how long they decide to stay. And so there were wonderful moments in training, because I think these moments happen more in training, where we'd get these aha moments. And for me, that was incredible. I learned, though, that winning hearts and minds and getting those aha moments was a very slow, methodical process. It was like one heart, one mind at a time. And you had to be satisfied with that. It wasn't like a sea change. Although, overall, I think as a human family, I think we've done a better job, you know, year over year in trying to be more inclusive. But then our human family will still find someone to hate or someone to discriminate against. Like, it's something that we can't seem to escape despite the lessons, right? So you hit the summer of racial reckoning in 2020 with the murder of George Floyd, and that's a pretty seismic shift in the way that, at least temporarily, people are thinking about inclusion and seeing it as an emergency. And I think, I was glad to see the money being put into programs, because I never thought they had enough money. But then, like I said, people were hired to do this work that maybe didn't have the training or resources that they needed at the time. And so went to, what is the easiest thing to understand here, right? Like, really inclusion for all, belonging for all. This is not just for one group that is suffering a crisis right now. People have multifaceted identities. You can be a white, queer, disabled, middle-aged, poor man, and have a number of different things that are interfering or impacting the way you show up at work. Whereas for me, I am a Black Jewish woman who, according to DEI, maybe I would have some issues, and definitely I can't take my skin tone off or, you know, some of these being Jewish out in the world. But also I'm middle class or upper middle class. And so I maybe don't, and able-bodied and straight. And so I maybe don't show up with some of the same things that impact me at work as the person I just mentioned. And I think that nuance was not a part of the push post, you know, in a post George Floyd world. So in that year, when I joined the SCBWI, or the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, I did that. Then my first thing on the job was working on our Black Lives Matter post. Then, you know, because it was children's books, and there were some statements about trans kids, we wrote a statement of supporting trans youth and their families. This was the year that our president called COVID the Kung Flu, and there was a lot of blame for our Asian community who experienced violence. And so we wrote, really scary. And so we wrote a statement on anti-Asian hate. And then in May of 2021, with the Gaza war at that time, there was a theme circulating that really overly simplified that conflict at the time, and left Jews reeling. I'm from LA, so Jews and non-Jews, if you were sitting in a restaurant in the Jewish neighborhood, people were being pulled out of restaurants and beaten on the streets, and this was happening in other cities as well. And so I started to write a statement, and that one required more scrutiny, more language, more, hey, we should probably mention Israel in that. And I said, Jew hate predates the modern state of Israel. We do not need to mention Israel in order to talk about harm to Jews. But the statement ended up being a little more all lives matter. So there was a statement at the end, the statement was attacked, and away we went from there. So the fallout from that, I was canceled. There were thousands. I had to delete my all that I'd had for many years. I quit my job. I had to hide. I went right into early menopause. Stuff.
Oh man.
So it was really, really stressful. I really wasn't back to myself for a good 9-10 months, and it still required some like huge effort on my part to do that. And in that time, Project Shema reached out to me. They'd heard about my story and thought, you know, we're working on this thing. We're seeing how anti-Semitism on the left is resulting in Jews being excluded or pushed out from progressive spaces because of their Jewish identity or cultural heritage. And we're curious if this framework that we have could potentially speak to the DEI model as you know it. And I peeled myself out of bed, decided. My kids and I still get death threats, by the way.
Oh God.
Yeah, so fun. I peeled myself out of bed and listened to Oren Jacobson deliver what we now call our Anti-Semitism 101 course. It is evolves. We meet multiple times a year to hone our deliverables. Cool. But I watched it and I just thought to myself, ugh. This is what I've needed this entire time in my own DEI practice, and how can I help? And so that was the beginning of my journey with Project Shema. I started out as a consultant, and when we got enough funding, became full-time. I was like almost employee number one with the team that had created the content. And I've been here ever since. I'm the vice president of engagement for Project Shema, which means I work to engage campuses K through 12 through university level, all the way through PhD programs, to bring learning arcs to combat anti-Semitism, understand Jewish identity, and basically normalize Jewish inclusion and safety in healthy, pluralistic, democratic societies and institutions. So it's something that's really, you know, important to me, especially since I've been, you know, a victim of it myself and continue to be. With, you know, it's not more or less, it's simply included, right? And Shema means to listen, to hear, to understand. And before I sort of before and in between joining Project Shema, I had co-founded Jubian Princess with my other colleague, Kiyomi Kowalski. And that was really because we also noticed inside the Jewish community, we could be more inclusive. And how do we bring corporate level DEI into Jewish communal spaces?
So that's like a real serious side quest that, like, I'm sure you're well aware of, like, in the Jewish community itself, we have this colorism problem, right? Mm-hmm. And it also reflects externally, right? A lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people think that Jews are Jerry Seinfeld, you know, and that's the cookie cutter thing, you know, and that's why, you know, the colonizer, white colonizer, you know, Western European monikers can stick, right? And like people like me, I have no way of saying, you know, hey, you know, and explain my identity. That to me it seems like there's a few things going on, right? And I want to ask you like a future question too, is like, there are more people like you and me and others who have mixed race backgrounds that are European, Black, Jewish, as well as other things, right? That we all kind of, and that kind of existence seems to be, have we're finding out more and more and more as time goes on through DNA, right? But that kind of existence is becoming greater, right? Like we're going to have so many identities where it's like, we're not going to know what to call ourselves.
So I think the fact that you even mentioned Jerry Seinfeld is perfect, because his mother was Syrian Jew.
Right.
So, right. So he's a Mizrahi Jew, and we're 15 million people. People think we're a billion, you know, I do these surveys of folks. They think we're a billion people, 250 million people, no. 60 million people, at least 4X of how we exist in space. But many people don't understand that over half of Israel would not be considered white in the United States,
nope.
Regardless of how, you know, they classify themselves. They do not use racial constructs here in the U.S. But what Jews have had to do throughout time and space in terms of thinking of their own futures is work within the systems where they find themselves. So
indeed,
there is not a rabbinical head of all of Judaism here, right, in the United States, but there is in the UK, because they have, you know, they have the head of the church there, right? So for us, we know in the United States, whiteness is a thing. And if you are leaning into safety, then many what would have been minority white presenting groups, whether it's Italians or Irish or Jews, when given the opportunity to blend into whiteness, many did. Even my grandfather, who went to an integrated elementary school, was darker skinned Jewish, Ukrainian Jew, but they called him Blackie. So for him to go to be, you know, to blend into whiteness, or just to say he was a white guy.
Yeah,
I know that was first harder, but like he also looked Jewish. Like I'm sure he either looked Jewish or Italian or something. Mm. I'm sure that, you know, when you're fleeing pogroms and the threat of a Holocaust or escaped a Holocaust, you are going to step in line with whatever that thing is that keeps you safe, and sometimes even adopt the isms, the racisms, the colorisms that intersect there. And what's so funny is when you go back and look at how we, you know, it Israel, or you know, or Palestine as it was Jewish Palestine, the Jewish, mm-hmm. When you looked at the Sephardim, the Mizrahi and Sephardic and Mizrahi Jews there, they discriminated against Ashkenazim. Like we were not considered to be the cream of the crop. It was, so I think the ways that societies in which we find ourselves, we are good adapters of into those societies for better or for worse. And as we're seeing with the United States in general, the Jewish community is very multi-ethnic. And right. we actually always have been. We have, Ethiopian Jews, Lemba Jews, Igbo Jews, Asian Jews, Kaifeng Jews, etc., Latine Jews, and we have every representation almost of most ethnicities, but now we're also either mixed race or multi-ethnic and different identities. A lot of those Jewish folks are like, I don't really want to be defined by the U.S. racialized lens. Like, it doesn't matter how dark-skinned I am and how I present to you, I'm a Jew. I'm just a Jew. Like, don't miss me with all your racial identity stuff. Like, I'm part of my tribe, and we have, of course, speaking of tribes, we also have Native American Jews, people like Lani Ampo and others. And so you really can't put us in a box. The growth of multi-ethnic Jews is expanding. They think conservatively 15 to 20%, more on the coast, more in big cities, and that number is growing. I fully anticipate that the Jews of Color Initiative, with their next survey of Jews across the country, will come up with a better understanding for us of what that number looks like, but it's growing. And so this presumption that we're all white, many Jews in the United States or Australia or elsewhere have access to whiteness, but if you're wearing a kippah, or if you're wearing a yarmulke, you're wearing clothing or identifiers that identify you as Jewish, or you have a Jewish last name or a Jewish look, then obviously your ability to blend into whiteness can go only so far. Like, they did a study a couple of years ago for HR people. I think it was either SHRM or Pyra did a study, and they asked HR professionals, if you knew somebody was Jewish, would you hire them? And 1 in 3 said no, they would not hire somebody if they believed they were Jewish. Okay. And I have friends, and I have friends who are not Jewish, who have Jewish last names or who look Jewish, and they're worried for their kids. That, just like a Jewish mom would be, like, they're just like, I don't know what's going to happen to my kids. And so that's been really interesting, is that, people care because they're impacted, but not because they identify. Right. And I think that's the lesson, that people forget about the history of anti-Semitism, is it really does impact everyone. Not because they might look Jewish, not because they could be identified as Jewish, but because we are this teeny tiny minority that, while we haven't asked for it and don't wish to continue to be this canary in the coal mine or this really interesting signal for societies, that democracy is about to take a big hit here and safety for everyone is on the line. So once you peel away safety for one group, and because we've been around for thousands of years, it's been us for a really long time. We know that when anti-Semitism rises in a society, that healthy, pluralistic, democratic societies can be at risk, and so too can be safety for other minoritized groups.
I love that we're having this conversation, because since I've noticed the gurgling of anti-Zionism, on the academic side and the artistic side, I'm in the creative world, these things show up very quickly. They're super strong right now. But my connection to my artistic community has changed, since 10/7. I've noticed that, like, the conversation, I don't know how to how to place it, right? It's like we could re-enter the DEI progressive space if just some of these thoughts and like things that we're talking about, right? Like that kind of show that, you know, not everybody has to have like a walled off struggle, so to speak, that like there actually is something called Jewish liberation, right? Uh-huh. That like Jews need to be liberated from anti-Semitism and hatred and misunderstanding, you know, for thousands of years. You know, it's like, that's so huge for people. They can't get it. You know, yeah. So like to be, and I think this work you're doing, it's a lot of work, right? It's like, you're not just doing a culture change at a company, which is like somewhat controllable. You're trying to do like weather change, you know, control the weather, which is a culture change. That's like such a superstructure that like, gosh, can you, you know? So I'd love to talk about like media portrayal and, you know, even like things that you and I were talking about earlier, that like we've had heroes and things that we've connected. And I teach graphic design history. I have for 20 years now. And there's this one set of ads that like, I love it. And then I'm like, why at the same time in this day and age? And it's the Levy's rye bread ads from the 60s. And it says, you don't have to be Jewish to love Levy's.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yeah. You don't have to be Jewish to love Levy's. I have to now Google this because I can see it. Wasn't it somebody?
Yeah, it was the DDB, which was Doyle Dane and Bernbach, which was like one of the first like mainstream Jewish ad agencies in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And so they had a multi-ethnic campaign where they used different people. Yeah. So what about that campaign for you?
So, you know, I've always thought it was funny, right? Growing up, because it was like, ha ha, yes, Jews are white, right? Like, look at these people who are clearly not Jews. To then,
but they all could have been Jews.
Exactly. The conversation we're having right now.
And all of them could have been Jews. How hilarious is that?
Like even the young black boy, right? Mm-hmm. Who is like, and maybe the Native American would probably be more markedly the contrast, so to speak, that they're trying to do. But these are ideas coming from Jews. So like the Mad Woman herself, you know, Peggy Olson from Mad Men, remember that show?
Yes.
So one of the personas she's like, she takes on is actually someone named Judy Perotus, who was an ad executive who worked at DDB and wrote the copy for that ad, right?
Oh, wow.
And the photographer of the people was Jewish. Bill Bernbach, right, is like probably the most famous Jewish ad executive in the Mad Men era. You know, like, man, just so I credit and discredit this ad as like setting up a cultural pillar that we seem to be really trying to like erode now, you know. And yeah. I'm not saying that like it clearly signaled it, because it was chosen, people laughed, right? Like while smoking in the office. And that's what we got as like something that made a generation spend a lot of money on rye bread, and they weren't all Jews, right? It's the crossover ad. Mm-hmm. But it does. It reinforces this stereotype. So
so interesting.
So yeah. Levy's, we need to pressure Levy's to do a new ad.
Yeah. You know, I love that idea. Like I didn't think about that. I hadn't thought about that ad in a number of years, but it was a very memorable ad. I worked in food. So you do think about how you portray people and mixed families and things. I remember when the Cheerios ad came out with the mixed family, like that was a big, everyone held their breath because, you know, there was going to be backlash and, you know, everybody survived through
Monday. Got over it.
I've been around in DEI for long enough to remember that. So I wonder, I definitely wonder how the Levy's ad went down. But representation for me has been really like seeing myself on screen or in books, children's books, or in any type of media, to see that. I do remember when Lisa Bonet came on screen for, you know, The Cosby Show and then A Different World. And I'm so excited. A Different World is, you know, Netflix is redoing that. Yes. I am going to shout out to Netflix and the producers to put some Black Jews in that show, please. I think it was a coincidence that Lisa Bonet was, it was like just a bonus for me that she was a mixed girl with my hair and my skin tone on a TV in a Black family. But then the fact that she was also Jewish and her mom was Jewish, and I was just like, oh my gosh. And then she married somebody who was Black and Jewish, and you know, it was just like, oh my gosh, this is like so exciting, because she's a little older than me. So I was just like, this is so cool. Like, life can just, there's a Lenny Kravitz out there for me. What? No, I'm just kidding. I'm not kidding. Yes.
It's Bechert. Yeah, it's Bechert.
Yeah, but that was just the coolest thing. And then for my kids seeing David Diggs, or seeing David Diggs play an Orthodox rabbi, and just, and, you know, I don't think it's enough. At the rate that we exist in space, I think, you know, I don't think there's enough of that. But I'm really delighted to see more of it. You know, like Puppy for Hanukkah, it was just such a great music video. So I do think representation is important, and it is important for us, for those of us who are in any Jewish space. I think you do this nicely, but those of us who are in any Jewish space, it is important to have that multi-ethnic, multifaceted Jewish representation, whether that's socioeconomic or ability or LGBTQ plus identity, skin tone, or nationality, meaning that, you know, that we come, that, you know, we are in diaspora because of violence, right? We all start in Israel, and, you know, unless you're a Jew by choice, even your soul was at Sinai, according to our, you know, when we talk futurism, the futurism of that moment, and the way that we look at, like, how do we incorporate people, our people going forward, was a phenomenal way to look at that, right? Yeah. But we are all Am Yisrael, right? We're the people from a place and a land, and it's Am Yisrael.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we wish the world could see, like, we survived, and then we're reborn as a people in our homeland, right? We've all not come home yet, right? But we may never, you know, there may be people who really want to do Deutschkeit, right? Where they feel like they can be just as Jewish in the place they are, and the way they are. That's amazing. I think too, though, like, I'm really interested in this, in these opportunities to reconnect with the DEI world. And I don't mean to say that I'm disconnected from it, but I feel like, because I'm Jewish, and because, like, I don't agree with everything Israel does, but I don't think it needs to be dissolved. You know, I think there's, like, certain things that are over the line, right? Because of things like Project Shema and just, man, taking the class and then going out and doing it, you know, and being in conversation and dialogue, super hard. Oh my God, super draining, right? It's like, I'm autistic, and I like, oh my God, you know, I'll do that better. You know, I ruminate, and it's like, but now I feel like, I feel chill. Like, I feel like I can get to a place where I'm, you know, all right, Hashem has me, you know, in this type of scenario. And it's like, I know I'm speaking esoterically when I'm trying to make a practical point here, but I really do. I really feel like I'm in this space, and I can see things so much more clearly, right? And I appreciate the clarity that you have, you know, even in this. And, like, you're right. You know, the representation's amazing. I think another phenomenon that is really cool is, like, the people who are emerging from, you know, the Jewish shadows, so to speak, you know, like, especially in Latin America. I have a lot of friends who are like, yeah, I'm the first Jew in, like, six generations. I brought it back, you know, and really have, like, these whoa stories, you know, about coming to
Brazil or someplace in South and Central Latin America. Like mind-boggling types of stories with that, you know. And I think the discovery of exiled Jewish culture in the Igbo, right, like you referred to before, you know, the work that like Rudy Rockman, right, and Noam Liebman are doing, right, Kavanaugh Films, where they go, the We Were Never Lost project, I don't know if you've seen their stuff, and like it's just I love it, you know, because I also feel very passionate as an educator, as like when we're all safe and we're all good, we're that's society, right? But gosh, I still feel like I'm not connected to these worlds, you know, and I'm always trying to figure out, and this is what futurism is about, is like building the bridges. There's going to be a future where we one day have to work together again, you know? I don't know if I have a question here.
Well, I think one of the things that you and I had talked about is how do we think about the future of Jewish life vis-a-vis also the Black Jewish solidarity, right? Mm-hmm. How do we connect our past to our future, and how does Afrofuturism inform Jewish futurism, and what are the conversations throughout time and space that our communities have shared, not just because there have been Black Jews. I mean, think about where Israel is. It's much closer to Africa than it is to Europe. And we know that people, when fleeing into diaspora, fled in all directions after the Romans expelled us in 70 CE and even before. But just more recently, you know, I've been doing some work with Van Jones and his team at the Exodus Project. And one of the things Van says, which I love, and I'm going to misquote it, so Van, forgive me, is that if you know, we all know this, the expression, if you don't know your past, you're doomed to repeat it. But if you do know your past, we can repeat the good parts so that we can align ourselves better. And Blacks and Jews and Black Jews have been in conversation around our shared liberation and distinct liberation for over 100 years, and probably even before then. And so when you talk about back to Africa movements and back to Israel movements, those two things have informed each other immensely. Bob Marley has a Jewish grandson named Zion, wow, whose mother's Israeli, right? And you know his songs, and when we think about Zion, which most people don't know actually what Zionism means to us. Zion is another word for this place in Jerusalem. For us, it's basically the ancient land, our ancestral homeland in Israel. And Zionism is the belief that Jews have a right to self-determination like any other people at its core. Are there other Zionisms? Are there extreme things on for any type of philosophy? Of course, but we hopefully don't identify an entire group and paint an entire group based on extremists in any culture, right? And so the Zionist movement and the Back to Africa movements have been speaking to each other. I love, for me, I love Black futurism, the Octavia Butler, Janelle Monáe's of our current, yeah, iteration. I mean, Octavia Butler, some of her stuff is so scary, but you can't look away. I went to an exhibit in the UK several years ago that said, I think it was in the UK, it was just everywhere. And I think it's on my grid and my Instagram, that there are Black people in the future. Like, you know, and there were these beautiful, you know, images of futuristic looking Black people. And it's so strange. I noticed it as a kid that there weren't as many Black people in futuristic worlds. There were definitely not Jewish people in futuristic worlds. But we're not going anywhere, either of us, right? And so one of the things that we've been able to do together is make really impactful changes to democracy in the United States, which has impacted the world. And so we are at a crossroads, even in our own, you know, democracy here in the United States. And we have to figure out a way for our collective futures to get the band back together. And I think Black Jewish people are at the intersection there, because we do have these conversations at our Thanksgiving tables and our Pesach tables. And so we have to have that conversation, whether we align in all of these things or not, and find a middle ground so that we can work towards the shared values and the shared understandings around our civilization and how we move forward.
Well said, really well said. I mean, I feel like there's a tremendous amount of opportunity in arts. You know, I know when the Black and Jewish community get together and in the past have made some pretty monumental things. Like I believe the, after being rejected several times, that like Billie Holiday was finally recorded by a Jewish man with Strange Fruit, with the first recording of Strange Fruit. And that like she literally had to sing it to him in his record store. And he was like, please, yes, let's do it. I mean, but I've had, so I work with an organization called Spill the Honey. And my colleague at my university, Judy Schindler, has done tremendous amount of work in the Black and Jewish world, especially in our city, Charlotte, Black and Jewish Alliance, Soul Food Shabbat, right? Which is just awesome things. And futurism is something we've talked about. And I say it's something that we really have in common. And, you know, of course, I'm an artist, so I come at it through the creative space, and I really feel like, right, thank God. And I feel like, you know, there's such a great language of dialogue, because we are distinct people, but there's also that middle space, you know, that we're talking about today. And I think like even that's a futuristic idea. It's like being in this liminal in between, you know, like gosh, I mean, that sounds like all sorts of futuristic space travel and time travel. You know, you're out of your fish out of water, you know, stranger in a strange land, kind of has this, and it's always through story, you know, like, yeah, I mean, there's so many, even Wakanda, you know, like the Black Panther and being a creation of, you know, white Jewish men, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, right, who changed their names to be white, to be in the safety of whiteness, right, as I like that. And working with ironically, his name is Billy Graham was the first artist to really make Wakanda into like by referencing ancient African patterns, right? I feel like there's kind of been this synergy in things. Even George Clinton, I saw this great documentary the other day about Parliament, and he was saying that like in the flashlight, you know, boom, 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 like is apparently like a melody he picked up from a Jewish friend of his at his bar mitzvah when he was a 13-year-old. Yeah, it's George that tells the story.
Wait, maybe I did hear that. But he wouldn't be the first one. There were other, really? Like, no, I think there was another artist that was saying the same thing, that there's like some of these songs that we know and love have like Jewish backbeats in them, or traditional Jewish backbeats. But isn't that wild? the Jewish engaged in the arts for, you know, and, you know, for Black artists for a long time. Right, whether it's theater or film,
Gershwin,
not all the happiest of endings, but
right,
we've been engaged. I'll quote Van again, like, you know, we don't argue with people we don't care about, right? If we're not going to get into an argument, and if we're in relationships, sometimes we're going to fall out. And but we still need to keep the family together.
Exactly. And I think it's, you know, so much of the work that you're doing, like just as a person, you know, and the organizations I was talking about before, like that for me feels like the real work. You know, when I'm talking about like, hey, I'm a community artist and I blah, 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 you know, like, yeah, I show up and paint with folks, you know, and work with them to do it. But like when I feel like, all right, the work that I'm doing that actually like makes a difference, that I feel like is impacting, like doing a mitzvah, you know, making the world a better place in the most Jewish way I can, is really open, keeping the tent up for this community. Do you know what I mean? Because like I have folks who are even younger than me, you know, who are in all parts of the Jewish community. And like, they still have crazy thoughts, you know, like these kind of hateful thoughts. And I'm always thinking like, man, what can I say to them? How can I, you know, and it's always through this demonstration, you know, I'm always telling them the work I'm doing, the things that I have going on. You know, I show them pictures of my Jewish relatives. I was telling you the story earlier. I'm going to one day find out who is my Black Jewish relative, who's Ashkenazi, right? But like, you know, I love Elisheva Rishon. Mm-hmm. I mean, just first of all, like, hey, her accent is like straight Brooklyn, like just rough. I love it. Like that's, and she says it how it is, you know. And I love folks who just know what's up. And
she's definitely a Black Jewish futurist. I love her style. I love the way that she organizes and speaks out and keeps it positive and focused on centering Jewish joy, because that's what sustains us, right? And that's something we have to.
And it's halakhic. Yeah. I mean, she's Orthodox, so she knows halakha, which, you know, are her rails, and she's doing her thing. You know, you're so right. Yeah. Have you worked with her before, or have you just seen her stuff?
I know Elisheva. We've been to Israel together. We've created awesome. The wall together. She created an organization called the BJZ Squad, which is Black Jewish Zionists. So she is behind the scenes mentoring, creating content with, for, and about Black Jews who have a little bit more presence on social media, or who are open to doing that, or even who aren't, but maybe like you in their work want to be able to have these conversations. So she's put a lot of her own time and resources into resourcing other folks like herself, including me.
She's phenomenal. Yes. And like, you know, we got Tiffany Haddish, who's become such a great voice. I mean, just, I've seen her in these debates. I mean, just really stepping up. I mean, I loved her as a comedian, you know, and like to see her really be a real person is phenomenal.
She's a force. I totally dig her. She and I have spoken at some of the same events as well. And I really appreciate her as well. When is this podcast coming out?
We'll probably be like second week of September, getting close to the Hagim. So.
Okay. Yeah. No, she's there. I can't say she's going to be doing some stuff, but if it came out later, then I could say, but so you'll have to cut this part.
Okay.
I'll tell you later. But yeah, cool. So she's cool. I'll tell you when I can, but yeah, no, she's amazing.
And you know, I love to cook and I live in the South. So having a Michael Twitty in my life, you know, is like a joy. I have his books. Yeah. Oh man.
I have his books too. Kosher Soul. And what's the other one?
Yeah, the newer one. Is it the Southern Jewish Cookbook? No. Well, all right, we're gonna cut this out. We're gonna find out right now. Shame on us. We're like, oh, we love you, Michael.
Michael Twitty did the Cooking Gene. He's won 2 James Beard Awards, and he has the Cooking Gene and Kosher Soul. And I think the Recipes from the American South. So yeah, and I've been fortunate enough to sit down and share and have some of his home cooked meals, and even meals that he's done for larger scale events, which has been so nice. But yeah, he's an incredible food artist and storyteller.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was, I live in the Carolinas, so I'm near Gullah territory. So like you can experience some of that, but you got to be invited. It's not like you show up and you're like, hey, I want to try the Gullah Geechee style. You know, like that's just not how it works. But it's something with respect. So he's somebody who's amazing. I mean, of course, like Maya Rudolph, in the Kishkas laughing forever on her. SNL.
Love her. Haven't met her, but love her.
Oh man. Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Then she's on both our lists here.
Right. Let me know if you get her.
I'm going to keep trying, that's a Jewish boy from Long Island can hope. Of course, Lenny Kravitz, like when I learned that as like a kid in the 90s, that was like, yes, because his music was so badass. And, his style was amazing. He kind of revived the whole hard rock thing from the 70s so well. And then, of course, I'm a child of the disco loving parents. So Tracy Ellis Ross, of course, the daughter of Diana Ross.
Phenomenal. Right? Love her. Yeah. She was on Girlfriends. I remember being really excited about Girlfriends. My kids watching Blackish and thinking, oh, look, here we go. We've got two generations watching for different reasons,
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. No, it's nice to have the representation. It would be nice if the representation were also Black and Jewish. Like there's some actors who are Black and Jewish who wear their Magen David, on screen, and it's really cool. And not everyone is always cast, to be themselves.
Right. I know I'm thinking sometimes like Eric Andre is somebody, right, who, it's complicated in Hollywood now. Like you can kind of get canceled pretty quickly depending on your views of Zionism and, what you say and whatnot. How have you felt kind of watching some of the award shows, and seeing just Jews in general in the, the LA Hollywood sphere kind of saying the things they are?
I mean, obviously it's disappointing when you feel like as a minority or minoritized person that you, in order to receive an award, that you have to speak out on something else entirely, or that you don't feel aligned with maybe the majority of your community, and that has to have its own kind of thing. But I think what we've done for thousands of years is try to figure out how to stay safe. And so I look at the folks who are doing that and imagine to myself that they're doing what they probably believe, is the right thing, but also there's a measure of like, how do I stay safe and still be who I am, since, there's no changing that, right? Like we already went through a phase of where we tried to convert out and conversos were still, slaughtered or expelled or, whatever. So, and we are an ethnicity. I mean, we're one of those few ethno religions where even if you don't believe in God and maybe you don't celebrate the Jewish holidays, you are still culturally and ethnically Jewish for the vast majority of us. So there are a number of people who are out there doing their thing. And I wish they didn't have to do that. I like you said, I don't agree with everything Israel does. I don't agree with everything any state does, certainly not these United States. But if I were to win an award, I don't know that I would feel compelled to speak out on what the Black community is doing, what women are doing in the society, what the United States government is doing, or the Israeli government is doing. I don't know that that would be my go-to statement with with things like that. So it's sad that they feel like they have to.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, there will be a time when we look back on this time and see what this chunk of years look like. You know, we'll have clarity, more so clarity on it, right? You know, Bezrat Hashem. So April, gosh, we could have a phenomenally long conversation. And you are so generous with your time. What are some things you're excited about in the space you're in, right, as an individual, that's coming up that you think like, I'm going to keep my eye on?
Well, for me, work is so important to me right now. So the fact that I have a grant that lets me give away some free or highly subsidized training to U.S. universities is really important. We have an equally important program for the K-12 space, which we don't have funding for. Campus schools have to pay on their own. So I'm hoping folks who care about K-12 space who are within earshot may want to fund, even if it's a small $10 donation to more. But I'd love to see our work expand more into K-12. For me, travel is always on the horizon. I travel for work and I travel for the joy of traveling. And I very rarely take off my Magen David, and I'm generally visibly, obviously Jewish. I traveled to Europe this summer, everywhere. And only one time did I feel like mortally, like if this guy could have gotten up from his table and hurt me, I definitely got a stare down. That was not a kind stare down. But you know, I have an opportunity when I travel and when I speak to deliver a different concept of what being Jewish is, and that's a powerful thing for people to understand that what they understand Jewish identity and Jewish values or who Jews are to be is standing in front of them perhaps differently than what they had imagined. And so I take my role as an ambassador very seriously. And I hope that in some small or big way that my time out from Hashem when I was canceled resulted in making, incremental differences for our community and the world.
April, thank you so much. This has been just such a great conversation. Thanks for letting me get into the under the skin, so to speak, of Jewish existence with you, because it's something that I don't get to talk about often, and not everybody really gets it. So I appreciate your wisdom and connecting with you on that. It was super cool. So
I look forward to future conversations, Mike. Thank you for all the work that you do and for your beautiful art.
You have been listening to the Jewish Futurism Lab with Mike Wirth, a weekly independent production of Mike Wirth Art Incorporated. You can connect with the show at jewishfuturismlab.com, and we're on all of your favorite podcast platforms. We'd love for you to subscribe, comment, and leave a review so other seekers can find the show too. New episodes come out Friday mornings, East Coast time. And if you or someone you know is a Jewish futurist doing fascinating work, message me on Instagram. I'm at Mike Wirth, W-I-R-T-H. Until next time, keep imagining, keep questioning, and keep building. I'll see you in the future.